hundreds of years. We were the only people who could publish. We really loved it.
It started largely to prove an ex-girlfriend wrong.
You give those tools to other people, surprise, surprise, they love it too.
She said there was no social value to any of the changes in information technology.
It's more transparent, more accountable, more responsive and inclusive.
I thought, no, there is value. It can bring people together rather than just separate them.
Hello, I'm Richard Adie. Welcome to the Media Report on RN Summer. It's a chance to highlight some of the best stuff we've done over the last year. And we begin with one of the boldest ideas in the news media world, open journalism. This is based on something that's always been true, but it's now true in a completely different way. Journalism is a two-way street. For most of the last couple of centuries, journalists have gone out into the world to find stories and then tell them to readers and listeners and viewers. Sometimes those people, the audience if you like, have been part of that process. They've witnessed something newsworthy, or they've rung up with a tip-off. Maybe they've leaked the documents. The most useful of them have gone on to become a reporter's contact. But mostly the model has been that there are journalists and there is everybody else. We report and you decide. Open journalism changes that. It almost conflates the two. As you'll hear, one of the world's leading mastheads, The Guardian, has embraced this model. Indeed, you could say it's gambled its future on it. But first, let's get to grips with what it is. Melanie Sills, the executive editor of Southern California Public Radio, but she spent most of her career in newspapers and last year took time off to research open journalism.
Journalism is inherently social. It's not something you write and put away in a drawer or broadcast just to a select audience. It exists to communicate with people. And so even the process of gathering information from sources is a social process. And so in the digital age, there are so many more ways to learn things, so many ways people are communicating and sharing information and informing one another that journalism needs to change with it to remain relevant. It's an approach to how you think about journalism. Do you think about journalism as a product, an outcome, or do you think about it as a service to the public? And if so, then open journalism makes a lot of sense.
The journalist who's done most to embrace this model is Alan Rusbridger, editor-in-chief of The Guardian in London.
The simplest way I can explain it is to think about the role of the theatre critic. We've got an excellent theatre critic. He's been sitting in the stalls for The Guardian since 1971. So he is, in a sense, the traditional bit that journalists bring and have brought since the 19th century, the expert, the authority figure. But if you say, what about the other 900 people in the audience who sit there alongside Michael Billington? Have they got nothing to contribute? The answer's obvious. Of course, it would be interesting to hear from them, and hearing from them would give you a more complete account of the evening. So that's, in a sentence, is open journalism. It's the idea that other people, apart from the journalist, can help you in your journalistic task of describing the world. To finish that, there are only two questions. One is how do you sort the interesting ones from the uninteresting ones? And the second is, does that work for other bits of journalism, like foreign reporting or investigative journalism or sports reporting? And in our experience, the answer is always yes.
You've gone further with it, I think, than most people. You've codified it, if you like. You've come up with 10, not rules, but principles.
Yes, we spent a lot of time obviously discussing this internally, and we tried to draw up 10 principles, which are either dead obvious, you know, like allowing the audience a say, and that you don't try not to publish material which is inert, to which they can't have a say, that you link to other material because that's the way information works nowadays. That you might want to consult the audience, as we now don't call them, but the readers, before you publish something, that a story doesn't end when you put your coat on and go home, therefore you have to work out how you're going to incorporate response. I mean, all these thoughts, I think, are either second nature to journalists working today, or if they're not, I think they should be. But I know there are some people who find all this very challenging and they want to go back to a 19th and 20th century model in which we weren't much interested in the relationship between what we did and other people, and we wanted to be regarded as and paid as authority figures.
So what does it mean in practical terms in running the newspaper?
Well, if you go along with the Billington principle that you're going to that you're interested in the other members of the audience, then you obviously have to create a forum for them, and you have to work out the filtering systems by which you sort out the good from the bad, and you're going to have moderation. So you're going to have to change the mix of the staff, and you're going to have to change the concentration from the paper to digital, and you're going to have to start making decisions about resources.
It's still very early days for open journalism, which means that some papers have made mistakes. Melanie Sill.
We went badly off track with story comments, in the newspaper business where I worked. And we had dozens of open lines every day, stories where people could go in and comment, and often people would ask questions, you know, well, what about this? And no one would ever answer those questions. No one ever responded to any of the comments except the other commenters. So if we're going to offer that invitation, we should be there to follow up and respond, answer questions, get rid of abusive material, and so on and so forth.
So journalists answering questions and thereby being more accountable. What about, though, news organisations not making news, but finding areas of public concern or interest and saying, well, look, we'll convene an event around this or host a discussion or something like that?
Yes, this is something that has been done before, and it's promising to see, sometimes because organizations have extra space in their buildings and they want to use it. The Texas Tribune, KPCC in Southern California, where I'm going, other organizations opening up their own facilities or becoming the hosts of events to take on issues. To me, this is a form of journalism when you convene a space where you're going to provide information and discussion of key public issues. I think this is a wonderful accompaniment to the digital interaction that we're able to have now.
I can see why you use the example of your theatre critic, Michael Billington, who's a brand in his own right, in a way, because everyone's a critic. Everyone who goes to the theatre has an opinion on what they're seeing or what they've seen. But The Guardian's also well known for some of its really tough investigative journalism. Indeed, the journalism that helped prompt the Leveson Inquiry was done at your newspaper. How would that work in an open journalism model?
Well, there are some great examples. You know, the death of Ian Tomlinson, the guy who died in the G20 protests. Nobody knew how he'd died, and the police said that he'd died of a heart attack. And one reporter just doubted that. He didn't believe it. And he posted the maps of the whole event and the timings and appealed for witnesses in the crowd. You know, this comes back to, you know, everybody can be not a journalist, but everyone has the capability to do journalism. And there was a hedge fund manager in New York who turned out that he'd captured on film, on his camera, the moment when a police officer had struck this guy to the ground.
Our camera tape picks up Ian Tomlinson in the last minutes of his life. Here he is in the grey top, just in front of the riot police. Now watch this riot policeman. Unlike most, his face is masked. He advances, strikes Tomlinson powerfully, then shoves him to the ground.
When the MP's expenses happened, there were 400,000 documents released in one day, you know, more than any newsroom can do. So we appealed for the readers to help us, and we had 23,000 readers who came in and helped us sort through the documents. Recently, we were doing a story about these new workfare proposals in the UK, and the journalist who was doing that posted a form that he wanted people to fill in, and that was how we discovered lots of examples of people at the coalface who were being asked to work for nothing. So every day now, journalists are coming in and saying, by employing these techniques, including in investigative journalism, we can give a better account of the world we're trying to describe.
In terms of reader or Guardian audience take up, though, I'm thinking there's an enormous difference between asking what music people are listening to, and you've been running a thing on that, or which famous person's body part they'd like to see, and asking them to review their MP's expenses. That is slog.
Yeah, but it's the same idea, you know, which is why you have to sort of almost run a campaign to embed the idea that in the readers' minds that they are necessary parts of what we do. We don't want them to just be a passive audience anymore. And, you know, of course, maybe 8 out of 10 of them are perfectly happy just reading. But if you can get 2 out of 10, and we now have something like nearly 70 million unique browsers around the world tapping into, that's a big resource. The other bit of it is this business of journalists are not the only authority figures. And that was a memorable phrase about 3 or 4 years ago coined by a writer on New Media who said, they know more than we do. And that's such a sort of obvious thing, which I think the penny is dropping with most journalists, is true. So therefore, in something like the coverage of science or the environment, the people who know most about the subject are not within the newsroom, and many of them are blogging very interestingly about it. So why don't we invite them in, put them on our platform, and share the revenues?
Is there a risk, though, that if you do that, that you lose something of the paper's distinctive voice, which has been an important part of its success?
Yeah, so in the Billington example, you don't get rid of Billington.
No.
We're not suggesting we hand the Guardian over, so we're not the Huffington Post. We're not just aggregating. We're not just saying, come on in and write the Guardian. None of this would work if we didn't provide the core of it, and if we weren't developing the skills of filtering and aggregation and curation in order to bring, in our view, the best of what's happening elsewhere. I mean, on the Arab Spring, there were very few news organizations that could afford, I mean, I can't think of any, possibly barring the BBC, who, you know, when there were 10 countries up in flames or protesting, could cover that whole story. But using the techniques of open journalism, you could cover it remarkably through live blogging and pulling in the best Arab bloggers and commentators. Now, that, you know, that is an act of judgment by the Guardian. Arabic-speaking specialists who would say, these people, in our view, will give you the best account. So we are certainly adding something to this mix of involvement.
So what kind of tools are you making available to readers? Because some of the things that you want them to do, they need help with, or they need access to software.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is very simple for anybody. So, you know, commenting on the bottom of an article is the most basic thing and is not difficult. But we've now got a policy of open data. Trust is a big thing in the modern media environment. So we're saying increasingly, don't just take our word for it. Here's all the data on which we are basing this story. And we'll publish all the data so that you can download it and work it out for yourself or do other things with it. And then at the other level, we have an open API, that's an open publishing system, where anybody can take anything that we publish and do things with it themselves. We watermark it so we can see what they're doing. But for instance, in the developers at Facebook and Google find the Guardian very easy to work with because of that, and that, you know, has recently led to us gaining about another 1 million readers a day through Facebook, younger readers, very difficult to get to by traditional publishing means, because we make things very easy for people to work with us.
This is the Media Report on RN. I'm Richard Ady. Today we're looking at open journalism, which has been most notably embraced by The Guardian in the UK. Here's a taste of their ad promoting this approach.
Someone tried to blow my house down, I'd do the same.
I knew the wolf. There's no way you could have blown down those houses. He had asthma.
But the wolf had asthma. So what's the truth about the pig's houses being blown down? Inside job.
There's no reason why those two houses, one made from straw, the other from wood, should have collapsed. Not even a healthy wolf's huff and puff could bring them down.
The three little pigs have confessed to conspiring to commit insurance fraud, framing the wolf in an attempt to cover their tracks. Their motive was financial, as they struggled to keep up with their mortgage repayments.
We have the whole ad on our website. Go to abc.net.au/radionational and you'll find it. It's a tour de force, and it gives you a sense of excitement about what open journalism could be. But Melanie Seale says, at the moment, especially in America, many papers have a long way to go.
I also view it as a very challenging and distressing time for many people who either work in journalism or rely on journalism, because in some areas, you know, newspapers or television stations have had to retreat so much from the coverage they do that communities have been impacted. So it is a very tough time, but there is a chance to seize the opportunities of the digital era and the culture shift that's occurring to improve journalism and to reinvest the public in journalism, which I think is the most important part. If we're asking people to provide financial support directly to journalism, either by donating to public media or by subscribing digital subscriptions, we have to recognize their stake in it and that this public is our greatest resource for doing good journalism as well.
Melanie Sill from Southern California Public Radio. Alan Rusbridger also acknowledges that there are genuine problems with the newspaper business at the moment.
Well, there is certainly a sort of besetting pessimism in the newspaper industry, I use that term advisedly, in which it all seems doom and gloom. You've got shrinking audiences, you're trying to preserve old economic models, and you're feeling generally paranoid and dismissive about these emerging forms of communication and connection. And I think if you get into that spiral, then you're finished. I really think, you know, if you think this is a story of decline and putting stockades around what used to exist. So I think being optimistic, embracing it, plunging into it, learning from it, is a story of growth. And of course, we don't yet know what the exact economic model is, but then nor do the pessimists. But I know which side I would rather be on.
So does he believe that open journalism will save newspapers?
Well, there are two things. One, obviously, what I'm describing enables you to access a far larger resource than a newsroom could ever do on its own. So in the sense that newspapers, news organizations are competing with the internet, which I think has to be a true proposition. You just have to think for a second about who's going to break a story first, Twitter or the Sydney Morning Herald. You know, 9 times out of 10, it's going to be Twitter. So in a world in which that competition is taking place, it's better to co-opt the resources than try to imagine that you can do it all from within the newsroom. So there's a sort of economic argument from what I'm saying. It's going to build larger audiences. And in the past, advertisers have wanted to go where the audiences are. And finally, the thing that advertisers want most are engaged audiences. And so what I'm describing is absolutely the way to engage audiences and make them feel that they're not just passive receivers of information.
I think you said something along the lines of, and I'm going to paraphrase you, this only works if you give us your time or your data or your money.
Well, that's a question we're asking readers at the moment, because the obvious thing to do is to say, give us the money. And the most, you know, extreme form of that would be the Times in London, which says you can't get any of our content unless you give us the money. New York Times has been a bit more sophisticated in New York. So, there are halfway house models. But it may be more interesting, and we've just had a really interesting readers' weekend here where we just threw open the building and we had 5,000 readers coming through discussing, you know, everything under the planet, but also the future of The Guardian. And that was a question that I asked them. You know, the most valuable thing you might want to give us is just data. It really helps us if we know who you are, where you live, a real identity and an email address. You know, that just having that, we've only got that for about 2% of the readership. If we could make that 10% of the readership, that would transform the business model. Time is the idea of other bits of The Guardian, like moderation, that you would be prepared to give up. Just like people get involved in Wikipedia. So I think there are things before you start putting a gun to their head and saying you can only get The Guardian content if you are prepared to pay for it that are worth experimenting with.
One of the people you had at your Guardian weekend was Clay Shirky, and I remember reading him a couple of years ago now saying, journalism is going to survive. I just don't see how the businesses that have provided it are going to survive at the moment.
Yeah, well, he's a really interesting thinker, and I did a session with him last Sunday, and he said, I mean, he was talking about the New York Times paywall, which is a kind of almost voluntary paywall, so you can get lots of content, and if you go through social media, you'll never hit the paywall. And lots of people are now trying that model, and he said there are different metaphors for what they're doing. So one is we created it, you've got to pay. Another is describing it as subscribers. And another metaphor is membership. Do you want to be a member of the New York Times or NPR, National Public Radio? Because if you don't do something, then we may not be there. He was very interesting just about how people are describing what they're trying to move to.
Alan Rusbridger from The Guardian. It's a long way from London to Canberra. I'll do that again. Alan Rusbridger from The Guardian. It's a long way from London to Canberra, in every sense. But open journalism is being practiced in the nation's capital. It's part of what the Riot Act does, as John Griffiths, its founder and still its driving force, explains.
Look, it started on November 2000, largely to prove an ex-girlfriend wrong, and has continued since then for most of its history as a volunteer effort for a bit of fun. And in about 2007, we had to turn it into a business because we had to do something with the checks Google was sending us.
I'm intrigued, largely to prove an ex-girlfriend wrong.
Well, I was working a lot online with, I was working for Capital Monitor, one of the boutique news services up in the press gallery. And then I started developing products, and then I was arguing with my girlfriend, who's since returned to London and has no idea the trouble she's caused in Canberra. She said there was no social value to any of the changes in information technology that were sweeping the world at the time. And I thought, no, there is value. It can bring people together rather than just separate them.
Right. Did you have a model in mind when you began it?
Well, the Slashdot website, which is an American news for nerds, it styled itself at the time, I think they still do, was a website where they were linking to sources on the internet, putting a little bit of analysis on, and then opening it up for conversation from their readers. And that was very much the model we were aiming for. For a long time, we had a very similar theme on the website to them. We've diverged since, but they were very much an inspiration. Only instead of IT, our niche was going to be things happening in Canberra.
I can remember Slashdot. I know it is still around. I haven't looked at it for a long time, but stories from readers and then user moderated discussion threads.
Yeah, a fantastically complicated moderation system, which we don't use anything like that for our moderation. It's all human judgment.
So how does the Riot Act work now?
Well, we've got two people handling the business side of things and going out and finding advertisers for the website, and then one full-time journalist, which is myself, also editing. I mean, I call myself an editor. I'm much more an editor than I'm a journalist, really.
You're essentially processing what other people's stuff.
Processing other people's stuff, we look at a huge number of primary sources. So, for instance, the Chief Minister's website for media releases coming out of the ACT government. There's a wide variety of websites that we have robots checking for when new things are put on them, and then putting some context and analysis onto things that appear online. But as well as that, our readers send in a large amount of the material that we end up using.
Well, looking at it now, you've got everything from coverage of the Canberra Raiders' latest game, not good news there if you're a Raiders fan, to an image of a Canberra. This one's clearly sent in by a user. It's of a rather foggy lake, Ginninderra. There's a police roundup, and there's a long discussion about a neighbour in an apartment block making a lot of noise while having sex.
Yeah, look, we don't mind being a little bit cheeky sometimes, and we considered the legal ramifications on that one, but it was...
There's a recording, isn't there?
There is a recording in there. It was a recording made inside the person having to listen to its home, though, so there's no invasion of privacy going on there, and there's no one identified. So it was one of those things. I mean, it's been fabulously popular over the last couple of days, and yes, we knew the readers would love it, and... but it is a legitimate discussion as well for what can you do in that situation.
It is funny, and some of the remarks posted would not be discussed on a family network like Radio National. However, it has prompted comments along the lines of how cheap and shoddy construction of apartments are.
Our readers will cover a lot of ground on things, and you're only seeing the comments that have been approved. There will always be comments that we decide we don't want to play host to.
So do users shape the stories you cover or cover stories themselves? Or is it more complicated? Is it about them commenting on stories that you're already doing?
There's a wide spectrum from the base of people just making comments. And sometimes a comment is so good and so insightful, and particularly when it's by someone who is at the scene of something that's generating news, be it a car crash or a fire, that will take the comment and then turn that into a news story, quoting the comment. That's rare. We might get something like that maybe once a month or so. But moving up the spectrum, we get readers submitting stories. Now, generally, no one will submit something unless they have some sort of agenda. Now, it might be I'm running a concert and these bands are going to be playing, and they'll send us some poster art, and that's fantastic. We love getting that sort of thing. To people who've got some grievance, be they had a bad meal in a restaurant, which we really need to know the reader well, because we are conscious that malicious competitors could be bad-mouthing each other. We don't want to play a part to that. But if the reader is long-standing and in good standing with us, then they get a lot more latitude with that sort of content. There's a limit in the world to the number of people with the skills to write a good news story who are willing to do it for free. It's a pretty narrow pool, really. And we might get a great, fully completed story, maybe once a month, that sort of thing. But we'll also get people just send us a photograph. Say, this is a funny photograph or just a beautiful photograph from around Canberra. And we'll just run it and say, here is a pretty photograph around Canberra. And people like seeing that sort of thing as well.
There seems to be less user-generated content on WriteAct than on Slashdot. I was comparing them both just before coming round. Mm-hmm. Slashdot still seems to rely on people essentially having strong opinions about technology.
Yes, I mean, we very much view what we're doing as a curation of the available resources, and a big part of that resources is what our audience is sending back into us, but also the police media stream, the government, what companies in Canberra are putting out through what's really conventional journalistic sources. But it's curating all of those and putting what we think at least is interesting material online, which seems to be working.
The other thing is the tone of Slashdot can still be quite cranky. You're not cranky. There's a kind of variation of tones depending on the story.
I often say never give people a chance to be negative on the internet, and certainly don't encourage people to be negative on the internet, because you'll end up with nothing but a stream of negativity, which is not a lot of fun to generate and not a huge amount of fun to read either. So we do certainly like to keep things upbeat, and we always prefer saying nice things about things. We'd rather hear about someone having a great time at a restaurant than someone having a lousy time at a restaurant. But sometimes things need an honest assessment, and particularly in the world of PR, and possibly more so in Canberra than other places, there is a crying out for someone speaking honestly rather than just sucking up to their sources.
Why do you say that? Because in Canberra, you've got the Canberra Times, you've got the ABC, which has a very strong local presence, you've got the other publications as well. It is pretty well served.
Well, back when 2000, we didn't feel it was being well served in terms of covering certainly what I was seeing information available for. But I wasn't seeing my point of view. Right. So I thought I'd share that more with the world, and then I'm quite happy to share the pulpit, having built it up to a point. There are some views that people send in that we just look at and say, no, we don't. They can start their own website if they want to carry on with that. But I certainly didn't feel that Canberra was that well served. It's a very small town outside of the public service, and people inside of the public service can't speak freely, and a certain clubbishness that we like to think we've opened things up a bit.
So what would you like to do with it next, John?
Once we get it on a sustainable business case with roughly 2.5 journalists, the next stage for us is to expand into other cities.
John Griffiths from the Riot Act. You'll find more information about all of our guests, plus Melanie Seale's paper on open journalism and Alan Rusbridge's 10 Principles on our website. Go to abc.net.au/radionational. I'm Richard Ady. My thanks to producer Kyla Slaven and sound engineers David Lawford and John Diamond. See you next time.
Listen to all your favourite RN programs on your smartphone using the free ABC Radio app. Suitable for iPhone or Android, this easy-to-use app also lets you listen to 18 other ABC radio stations, including our specialist sport, music and pop-up event broadcasts. With inbuilt links to social media sites and access to online schedules, you can find all the details on how to download this free app from the RN front page. Then simply start listening.